down shortly here, and H minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And it is Saturday, the 3rd of December, in the glorious future year of 2022. And let's see who we have in com. Roly is here, listening from Australia. And we've got X1 from Belgium, and those are two places about as opposed to each other on the globe as you can possibly get. Northern Lights up in Wisconsin, Tobe in Omaha, or wherever it is he goes to have his cat bus serviced. But yes, what am I doing this week? What am I going to talk about this week? A good question, always a good question. I am here in Munich. Next week at this time, assuming that all goes according to plan, I will be coming to you once again from my home in Fort Worth, Texas, USA. So, international travel is always exciting, he said, in a rather jaundiced voice. I got an email today from the travel agency saying that ship travel between Europe and the U.S. East Coast ought to be available again beginning sometime in the spring. So that'll be interesting if I can actually make it happen. I was planning on doing that in 2020, but that was unsuccessful. You know, a lot of things just didn't happen. Anyway, what has been happening? What am I even talking about here today? Well, I will remind you to go back and listen to yesterday's Hear Now the Words archive, because I played, in fact, let me drop a link into com. I played a record called Atomic Year 25. Which was a documentary produced for broadcast on the radio, yes, the actual radio, by Argonne National Laboratory in 1967 as a commemoration of the very first nuclear fission chain reaction initiated by human beings on the 2nd of December 1942. Under conditions of strict secrecy and a disused football stadium in Chicago, Illinois. And the team which created that first nuclear reactor, Enrico Fermi's Chicago Pile 1, went on to become Argonne National Laboratory. And so it is that Argonne did this radio documentary. They did a number of radio programs, as it turns out. I've just purchased a set of three LPs. I have already two others, each of which, on each side, there are two 10-minute programs. The first two are called Let's Talk About the Atom and Let's Talk About the Atom 2, and then there is Let's Talk About Energy. I believe there's a Let's Talk About the Atom 3, judging by some of the papers that were included with Let's Talk About Energy, but there's no I can't find a mention of it on Discogs, so I just have to do some more searching. I've also found out that the American Nuclear Society picked up where Argonne left off, literally with the same narrator, and they did a series of three triple LP sets, again with a 10-minute, two 10-minute talks on each side, and I'm going to try to get hold of those, but there's only one of those for sale on Discogs at the moment, and the guy wants $50 for it, which is a bit high, I think, considering that, I mean, I paid $25 for Let's Talk About the Atom when the previous sale that was recorded on Discogs was $12. So, I mean, by being willing to buy these things at all, I'm clearly running the price up. But on the other hand, I also found there was, on eBay, somebody selling a 45, a 7-inch 45 single of 15 and 30 second and 1 minute programs from Argonne, which, anyway, somebody had it up for auction. Their opening bid was $90. Again, these were made to be played by radio stations in between programs. Well, I checked it out and I discovered somebody else had the exact same thing for $10, and so I bought that. And so that's waiting for me when I get home. Hopefully they didn't try to shove it into my post office box and break it in half. Generally speaking, the people at the post office have more sense than that. So one reason I get my stuff at a post office box rather than having it delivered to my home, my dad had some horror story about joining a record club and finding that they tried to fold the records to get them in his mailbox. No way, Jose. Let's see, other than that, so I failed to do something this past week. On Thursday, I'd been seeing there were leaflets which had been pasted up around the neighborhood talking about how there was going to be a lecture on Thursday the 1st at 7 p.m. local time. And the headline is, Angekommen in der Klimakatastrophe, was wirst du tun? Anyway, and it's from an outfit called Letzte Generation, Last Generation, and promising that there was going to be a lecture where one could come and hear about their plan. Now, the thing about it is, on the one side it says, Vortrag gehalten von Ernst, der in diesen Tagen in Berlin Widerstand leistet. On the other side it says, gehalten von Anna, die in diesen Tagen in Berlin Widerstand leistet. So either Anna or Ernst, one of the other of them, who was the leader of the resistance in Berlin in recent days and was going to come and talk. And I really did want to go, but I wound up not feeling very well on Thursday and taking a long afternoon nap, and then spent my evening preparing casserole from the leftover turkey, which is considerable, I mean, ignominious in comparison. But what I did previously, firstly, I made up a new set of German leaflets, which have on one side artwork with a smiling Atom logo, and they say, homeopathic energy policy? No thanks. And then on the other side, this was, I have to credit Lars for this. There's a big black rectangle which is scaled to German energy sector carbon dioxide emissions as reported for 2019. And then there's, the thing is, on the back of this flyer, you know, there's all this puffery about, you know, the climate collapse is beginning quickly. We are the last ones who have any chance to do anything about this. We have to do it in the next few years. And, you know, something about, you know, science and technology and historical tipping points and this, that, and the other thing. And then, you know, you know, and our ecosystem is going to collapse and all this. And then when you read Unsere Forderung, basically when you read about their actual plan, they just say, we want to impose a speed limit on the Autobahn and make public transit more affordable. Well, here's a fact, which I looked up, and it comes to me courtesy of the folks at Nuclearia, and they got it from the Bundesministerium für Umwelt, the German Environment Ministry, that out of a German energy sector collective emissions, carbon dioxide emissions of 644 million tons, that's the 2019 figure, that a 130 kilometer per hour speed limit on the Autobahn is estimated to save about 2 million tons a year. That's also about what a ban on domestic air flights is expected to save. So both of those are pretty much symbolic measures. They're not practically effective measures. And so in this big black rectangle, I then have a smaller white rectangle, which shows the size of that reduction. And then I have a somewhat larger black rectangle, a white rectangle rather, amounting to about 7 million tons a year, which is emissions reduction from operating a nuclear power plant for a year. Now, I had to calculate this three different ways before I was satisfied. Because the thing is, if you calculate it just assuming that it's replacing gas at 400 grams of carbon dioxide emission per kilowatt hour of electricity generated, then you get a savings of about 4 million tons a year, 4.5 million tons a year. If you assume coal at somewhere between 800 and 1200 grams CO2, even with the lower figure, 800 grams per kilowatt hour, then you get 9 million kilowatt hours a year of savings running a nuclear power plant instead of a coal plant. And that's a real trade-off because Germany is reactivating or prolonging the life of coal-fired power plants while still shutting down nuclear plants. And then the method I wound up going with, which I think is a very fair statement. As I say, it's not the highest figure I could come up with, but I think it's a very fair statement. You get about 7 million tons if you simply calculate, okay, so 1,400 megawatt power plant, 30% thermal efficiency, 8,000 hours a year, which is typical. You take that number, basically, of joules, and then you look at the International Energy Agency's mean figure for energy intensity of, for carbon dioxide, rather, emitted per megajoule of energy produced in Germany. Anyway, and so I took that figure, and that gave me about 7.2. So I just rounded down to 7. So I think that's a very fair figure. But it shows you there are many different ways to do your accountings. Many different ways to do your accounting. That these questions are complex, right? And part of the complexity is just that the world is complex. I've been reading, you know, the 1955, the proceedings of the first Geneva conference on the peaceful uses of atomic energy. And what can be said about it? Well, there's a whole long section where every member of the United Nations was asked to submit what does your country expect for the development of energy needs for the next 50 years? And the different approaches they all take are just amazing. Some of them are very short notes and just deal with, for example, there's half a page on electricity supply in New Zealand. There's like a page and a half on the energy situation in Greece. And then other countries provided, you know, 20 or 30 page long descriptions. The one that I thought was kind of unfortunate was, of course, that Belgium submitted a paper which dealt with the evolving, you know, evolution of the energy situation in Belgium, and it's a very interesting paper. It brings out, among other things, this really important and interesting fact, and I'll read it to you in the form that it was presented, because I think this deserves to be read. Hold on just a moment while I grab it from here. Yes. So this is from a fellow named Van Miele, who was chief of the research division of the Société pour la coordination de la production et du transport de l'énergie électrique, which was abbreviated CPTE in the inscrutable French fashion. And he says, now, since the end of the last century, he's speaking of the 19th century, of course, the primary energy needs remain essentially stationary, while the useful energy needs increase greatly. Thus, in Belgium, for instance, primary power consumption suffered certain variations since 1900, but on the whole it did not increase as markedly as did the overall economic activity. In the United States, the useful energy or power consumption per inhabitant nearly tripled between 1917 and 1947, but primary energy or power increased by only 7%. In Great Britain, the primary power used per inhabitant decreased a little since 1887, while the consumption of useful power tripled. The relative stability of the consumption of primary energy, as compared to the rapid increase in the need for useful power, is one of the most salient features of the present period. It is due to the technical progress which made it possible considerably to better the efficiency of the transformation and utilization of the sources of primary power in every field: railroad tractive power, steel industry, gas and coke production, electrical energy production, etc. The efficiency achieved may still increase. In many fields, electric plants, heating, etc., some progress may yet be achieved. In others, however, the theoretical limits have been reached, while in yet others they are very close to those limits, and much closer still to the practical limits, which are subject to all the contingencies of industrial exploitation. We cannot now look for any progress of the same order of magnitude as in the past. Now, this is a really interesting set of facts. And what accounts for it? Well, the short answer is, the biggest single thing that accounts for it is electrification and the steam turbine. These two things go hand in hand. So electrification meant that myriads of small engines were replaced by electric motors. Now, small engines are not as efficient as large engines, but the difference isn't terrible. Small boilers, however, are very, very inefficient, particularly boilers which are used intermittently because there's heating up and cooling down, there's all kinds of losses from boilers, which are reduced when you scale those boilers up. So even if you're burning the exact same fuel, and you're using it in the engines with exactly the same characteristic, using central boilers instead of myriads of distributed boilers really improves your efficiency. And then you have the changeover, because when Edison installed his first central station electric generating plant in New York City, the typical fuel efficiency of the best steam engines, the thermal efficiency of the best steam engines, was perhaps 5%. The thermal efficiency of the Parsons turbine, thermomechanical efficiency, is more like 40%. In fact, it got to be like, just purely on a turbine basis, 80 and then 90% of Carnot efficiency. What this means is that essentially you went from, in the best case, recovering 5% of the energy of the fuel as electricity in 1880, to recovering 40% of it by 1950. That's pretty spectacular. And because as the demand for electricity grew, larger and larger stations were built, meaning that the latest thermal generating stations were the largest and accounted for the biggest part of the load. The average efficiency of the whole fleet averaged over the amount of time they operated per year, because what would happen is that the older and less efficient stations would be relegated to peaking use. In Britain, for example, in 1955, they quoted the latest stations at 40% efficiency and the average for the whole country as 37.5%. Well, you can see then why it was possible from the 1870s, or from the 1880s to the 1940s, yeah, from the 1880s to the 1940s, to triple the amount of energy actually used while increasing the amount of fuel used by none at all. The amount of fuel, coal primarily, that was used remained static. The amount of energy consumed multiplied by 3. Well, you can't really get any better than that, unfortunately. 40%, so 60% thermal efficiency has been achieved in gas turbine combined cycle power stations, but they have to run as base load. The average efficiency of the system, even with lots of those kinds of plants in it, is still more like 40%. Ultra supercritical coal-fired steam stations can achieve 50%, although the cost of maintenance and the capital cost associated with that is awful. Ultra supercritical steam is extremely corrosive and destructive to pipework and stuff like that. Anyway, so we really can't look for any such gains from efficiency as in the past. And people talk about energy efficiency, and I don't think they know what they're talking about. Because firstly, we have Jevons' paradox. I mean, well, when we were reducing the amount of energy that you had to use for a single unit of final consumption, why didn't energy, you know, fuel total demand go down? Well, the answer is, as you get more efficient at using energy, every unit that you use benefits you more, which is an incentive to use more units. Now, there probably is some kind of saturation, but we're certainly not there yet because, again, we have a desperate need for, in places like the East Cape of South Africa, desalted seawater. We need a lot of it. See, Northern Lights is trying to tell me about somebody called Tunnel Bob, which is a terrifying thought. Oh, I see. Somebody who just spent his time underneath the... Yeah, so many places, large campuses, for example, have district heating systems, and older systems generally run by steam. I've mentioned that before. Newer systems are pressurized hot water, but most American systems are older, and they run by steam. There is a guy named Robert Grunewald who apparently is in charge of, or certainly spends a lot of time in, the steam tunnels under the University of Madison, and indeed visits other places. But he says, don't try and sleep in them. It gets hot enough in there that you'll die. Well, that's good to know. But yeah, so there is a guy named Robert Grunewald in the steam tunnels underneath Madison, Wisconsin. Interesting. But yeah, so end efficiency of energy use only gets you so far, and we've about reached the frontier of improvements in many senses, which means that the more energy we want to use, the more primary energy we have to produce. And that means, for example, every time you install a data center, it means burning more fuel. Either directly, or of course the fuels that go to make wind turbines and PV panels and all those things, which aren't free. Now, I mentioned last time, you know, in places like California, they have imposed mandates, legal mandates, saying you have to get a certain proportion, escalating all the time, of your energy from certain named sources, no matter what the cost, which is perhaps unwise. And in California, at least, they've extended this to where they're now imposing storage mandates, that you must have a certain amount of energy storage on your system. Again, no matter what the cost, no matter what the efficiency. There are a number of economic questions associated with this, but I'm happy to say that I have come up with a scenario in which one energy storage system makes some kind of sense, and this is compressed air energy storage. Now, I've told you in the past that compressed air energy storage is all around a bad deal, because when you compress air, part of the energy goes into raising the pressure, and part of the energy goes into raising the temperature, essentially. You pump that into caverns underground, and it's very likely that a substantial amount of the heat, or into tanks above ground, I suppose, but that would be very dangerous, a substantial part of the heat diffuses away so that when you bring the air back out, it's at a substantially lower temperature than when you pumped it down. And that means when you expand it through a turbine to turn a generator, you get much less energy than you would have to begin with. Well, I thought about this for a while, and I thought, in what situation does it even make sense to do this? And I said, well, here's one. If you have something that consumes a lot of electricity and produces a lot of waste heat, Now, here's the key. If Facebook, for example, really wanted to run their data centers on 100% renewable energy, the way they claim they do, which is a lie, their data center near Fort Worth uses electricity from the nuclear power plant at Comanche Peak, mostly, and from the coal-fired power plant at Big Brown, because they come 24 hours a day. But they've bought contracts, contracts for wind and solar-generated electricity elsewhere, which they're allowed to trade those low-value intermittent kilowatt hours against high-value steady kilowatt hours, one for one, which, as I've said before, is a scam. But if they really wanted to run those data centers on 100% renewable energy, they could do it with compressed air energy storage, because one of the major requirements for a data center is cooling. So what you can imagine is we have this turbine hooked to a generator, and when the demand from the data center is higher than what's coming in from the wind and solar, particularly when the demand from the data center is highest, we begin letting the air out of the caverns through the turbine and expands through the first stage of the turbine and drops in temperature. Gets pretty cold, in fact. So we take that and we run it through a heat exchanger at constant pressure so it absorbs heat from the cooling in the data center, preferably liquid cooling, obviously. Then we run that through another heat exchanger. But then we run it through another stage of the turbine, and then back out through another heat exchanger, and so on. And so when the load on the data center is highest, when it's demanding the most energy, not only for running, but also for air conditioning, we cut that air conditioning load out. We actually use that waste heat to generate power to run the data center. Doesn't that make sense? Anyway, so that might actually be an economical application for compressed air energy storage, which otherwise, as far as I can tell, is kind of a loser. Now, I'm just going to mention, of course, December of 2022 marks the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 17 mission, the last time that any human being set foot on the surface of another celestial body. And I have been invited to participate in what's called the Last Breakfast, which sounds a bit ominous, but the Sacramento chapter of the National Space Society for the past few years has been doing what they called Breakfast on the Moon, which was a series of events held at 7 a.m. Pacific time, I think, anyway, Zoom meetings, basically conferences for members of the NSS around the world to join in. And they've invited a variety of speakers, and I was actually one of the speakers who was invited for their Apollo 13 episode. And so for the Apollo 17 episode, which is coming up this Saturday, it'll be about 5 or 6 hours, I think, before this show on Saturday, I've been invited to submit a 3-minute segment or reflection and join in on that. They say you can do it live or you can submit a pre-recorded video. And because I'm traveling Thursday and Friday back to the United States, I'm probably going to try and do the pre-recorded thing rather than do the rather than try to join in live. But if I do, well, either way, I'm going to try and record that. I didn't necessarily succeed at that before. And it will show up sooner or later on one of my Anon radio shows. But yeah, and of course, we may have some news soon from NASA's Artemis 1, their unmanned flight test of the Space Launch System and Orion capsule. Again, if you go back a couple of weeks in the Anon Radio archives, you'll find the link that I gave to the testimony that I made back all the way back in 2009 about when that, back when it was still called Constellation Program and not Artemis Program, back when it was still called Ares and not SLS, very much the same thing. Back when Orion was just Orion and not Orion Multipurpose Crew Vehicle, not that it's obvious what purpose it has at all. But yeah, so that's what I'm going to be doing Saturday before this show, I guess you'd say. And so I hope to play that and make some good use of it. But as ever, you've been listening to A Step Farther Out on Anon Radio, a surface of the SDF Public Access Unix System. Please send your cards and letters commenting on these shows to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I'm very likely to read them on the air. I'm also very likely to send you something nifty in return. You can also support these broadcasts, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, patreon.com/publiusreads, and thank you.
7, 6.